You're listening to The Moment, an interview podcast series on life. We interview and capture conversations with creative minds, thought leaders, disruptors, and the people that are doing what they love while challenging the status quo. You can find the show notes on our website, themomenthq.com, and follow us on Instagram and Facebook. But for now, let's dive into The Moment. Hello and welcome to another episode of The Moment HQ, Uncovering Your Life-Changing Moments. I'm Monica Cade. Today we're chatting with Tyler Farnham, who has spent the last decade doing what he loves, ocean lifeguarding and teaching surfing. In April 2009, Tyler suffered a near-death skydiving accident, breaking his legs, arm, jaw and losing 9 teeth. The following year, Tyler wrote and self-published his book, Reaching Cloud 9, began giving motivational seminars throughout Florida while relearning to walk, surf, skydive, and lifeguard. Currently, he's working on his second book, Beyond Cloud 9, and hoping to one day give a TED Talk. Tyler is always trying to push others to live out their dream and do what they love. And I'm super pumped for this conversation, so let's begin. Hi, Tyler. Thanks for joining me on the show.
Yeah, hi, Monica. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. So you've had a pretty incredible life-changing moment and incredible journey. Now, for the listeners who might not be familiar with your story, I was just wondering if you could give us a short rundown on who you are and like how you got into skydiving and also when your love for surfing began.
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, it all started just growing up in a small beach town, Cocoa Beach, Florida, in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And I had two loving parents, a sister, a couple dogs. And luckily, I was right across the street from the beach my whole life. So every day just consisted of taking the dogs over to the beach, going for a surf. I was about 5 years old when my dad really started pushing me into waves. Mm-hmm. You know, I got a big love for surfing. From there, I mean, it definitely took over my life. But in a town like Cocoa Beach, especially Florida, surfers know that we don't get waves, consistent waves year-round. So. Mm-hmm. I skated for years, but then skydiving really came into my life when I was 18. I saw a movie, Point Break,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
and it really just got me so interested in skydiving. I was like, oh, I got to do this. This looks amazing. So on my 18th birthday, a few friends and I went and we did a skydive, and from there I was hooked. I loved it.
Yeah.
And I still kept surfing, but again, not having waves every single day, I needed something else to really get my thrill, you know? And yeah, I started jumping out of planes, and I continued to do so for about 7 years until the day of my accident. It was pretty much like a part-time sport. I never really got 100% like dedicated to skydiving. It was more of like a once a month kind of thing. I'd just go down to the drop zone and do a jump. Mm-hmm. Again, surfing was pretty much always number one for me. But yeah, it was a very, very interesting day, so to speak, when that time came up.
Yeah, so I mean, I've started reading some of your book, and I kind of know a little bit of that particular day of that jump. But you were saying in the book that it just felt like any normal jump that day. You didn't feel any different. Nothing was unusual.
Yeah, I mean, it really was a normal day. The only thing was my mom had decided to do her first ever tandem skydive, mm-hmm. and I'm really close with my mom. I think I'm closer with her than anybody else on this planet. Mm-hmm. And to hear that she planned to go and do a skydive was mind blowing, because she never once ever looked at any footage really of me jumping out of planes. She was never really that excited about that whole part of my life. Mm-hmm. So yeah, when she sent me this email saying, oh yeah, you know, my best friend Linda and I decided we're going to jump out of a plane, it was a normal day, but at the same time, having my mom there made it just a special day. But as far as the skydive itself, for me, mm-hmm. I didn't, you know, it was just, yeah, just a casual jump. Just going, yeah. Okay, I'm stoked to get to the ground, to get pictures of my mom coming in.
So growing up while you were jumping, did your mom ever want you to not participate in the sport?
No, she didn't. I mean, it was... My mom knows me better than anybody on this planet, I think. And she just knows that if I'm passionate about something, I mean, she just wouldn't want to get in the way of that. You know, I mean, it's like my tattoos. When she first saw that I was getting tattooed, she wasn't thrilled about the idea, but she was like, you know, this is my son and this is who he is. This is what he wants to do. But I will say, she wasn't too thrilled to hear that I got back to skydiving after my accident. That was, that was another story, but again, she wasn't angry or she wasn't, you know, it was just, she just accepted it, you know, accepted her son.
Yeah. And I'll ask you about that later, because when I found out that you went back to it, I was pretty amazed. Yeah. So we'll go back to that, but maybe we can talk more about that particular jump. And so you basically jumped out of the plane and everything was going according to plan. And then can you tell the audience from when things started to go wrong and what was going through your mind at that time?
Yeah. So basically, again, going back to that jump, it was, besides my mom being there, it was an average jump. So I exited the aircraft. I think it was around 13,500 feet. Mm-hmm. And I decided to deploy my parachute a little bit lower than I typically did, around 3,500 feet. Mm-hmm. And as soon as my parachute deployed, I knew something was wrong right away. I began spinning violently. Mm-hmm. And I'll right away say that I broke many rules that day. I mean, I was an experienced skydiver, but what I should have done, I did not do right away. I knew there was a problem. I began spinning and I tried to correct the issue by pulling on what's called the risers. So it's basically the lines that connect your harness to your canopy. And by doing that, I was able to fly straight. Mm-hmm. And I said to myself, if I can just hold on to my risers, I can just, you know, prepare for a hard landing and just go down to the ground, fly straight in, you know? And
yeah.
So I held down on my risers with, you know, all my energy, everything. And then eventually I just lost all my strength, had to let go. And when I let go, I began spinning again. Mm-hmm. And at that point was when I checked my altimeter to see how low I was to the ground. And when I checked my altimeter, I was like around, if I recall, 800 or 900 feet, which is pretty low. Mm-hmm. And my decision, to this day, I still question myself, especially when someone asked me about my decision and what was going through my head. But with skydiving, everything is such a, you have to make decisions so quickly. Seconds are so crucial. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't make that decision right away, whether I should cut away my main parachute or not, because I saw how low I was to the ground. So I said, okay, well, what do? I have a split second decision. And I was like, I think I'm too low to cut away. I don't think I have any sort of a chance. Mm-hmm. So by just taking those maybe 5 seconds to really think about my decision and debate on my decision, I was already out of time. And from that point, I believe from that centrifugal force of spinning, and also just due to the sheer fact that I thought in my head that I was going to die, I lost consciousness, because from that point, I blacked out and I don't remember anything until I think it was 6 days later. So from the point of me jumping out of the plane to the point of probably blacking out had to have been less than, I'd say, close to about a minute. So, I mean, everything happened so quickly. So my decisions that I made were very, very crucial. And yeah, I just made a decision last minute that should have cost me my life.
Mm. And so when you're making these decisions in your mind, were you panicking or did you feel like you were quite calm and that you were just going through these thoughts in your mind?
You know, I felt pretty calm in the beginning, but then when I looked up to my parachute after I tried to right away when I started spinning and I looked up to my canopy to see if there was any sort of obvious malfunction and didn't see any, that's a good question. I never really thought to myself if I really panicked or not. I think in the final seconds, I think just the sheer thought of this is it, I'm going to die. Like there's no, I don't have a chance at this point. I'm too low to cut away my main parachute. Mm-hmm. I could say there's a good chance I did have a bit of panic.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was a great question. No one's ever asked me that before. And I never really thought too much about that. But if I did, I was probably in just such a different zone, you know, with my thoughts of everything going wrong that I can't really remember. But I wouldn't be surprised if I did have a bit of panic towards the end. But everything up to that point just felt casual, you know, because I had quite a few jumps under my belt. So
yeah,
skydiving itself, like I still got that bit of a buzz when I jumped out of the plane, the free fall. But yeah, I think once everything started going wrong, I was just going, okay, I think I'm out of time here.
Mm-hmm. And were your decisions instinctive, do you think? Because you said that you were breaking the rules of skydiving, and obviously you're registering that as you're thinking. So do you feel that maybe you were just acting on instinct and that was probably the better decision than to follow, you know, the rules that you're taught?
No, to be honest with you, I'm really surprised because I didn't mention it. I think it was 2004. I did have a cutaway, you know, so I did actually have a malfunction parachute in the past.
Yeah.
And I used the emergency procedure and I cut away my malfunction parachute and I deployed my reserve parachute, landed safely to the ground. Everything was good. And even to this day, I'll always remember the emergency procedures for if something goes wrong. But I think that day, to be honest with you, Monica, even though it didn't register to me that emergency procedure so quickly, I think my mom being there gave me – I think part of me was just thinking maybe I don't want to have such a dramatic, you know, experience for my mom's first skydive. And when I say dramatic experience, I mean having to use my reserve parachute, because obviously I'd have to tell her when she gets to the ground, like, oh, mom, you know, I had a malfunctioned canopy. And, you know, instead it was a bit more dramatic than that. But for me, I think the biggest part of it was my malfunction was such a, it was different because it wasn't really an obvious malfunction. It wasn't like a visual where you could look up at your parachute and see, okay, there's a problem here. And like one of my lines is over the parachute and that's what's causing me to spin, or there's a tear in the canopy. It was like a tension knot kind of thing that just, it kept one of the risers or one of the steering brakes out of reach. And again, it was just something that I just thought so long about, just going, I think I can correct this. But as far as the instincts, I'll always remember there's a rule of twos. You try two attempts to fix a problem. If that problem isn't fixed in two attempts, cut that parachute away. That's why you have the reserve. But yeah, my thinking that day, I have no idea. I again, maybe it was the fact that my mom was experiencing something that I loved so much for so many years. And then just the thought of something possibly going wrong threw me off where I should have been, you know, as far as going back to my emergency procedures. And yeah, so it's been like 7 years, and it's still something that it's hard for me to even explain or think about or really grasp sometimes, because everything was just so strange that day, you know, and the way that I reacted, because I knew what to do. But the fact that I didn't was so strange. Like, why did I not just do what I was programmed to do in cutting away that parachute?
Yeah, that's so interesting. I can imagine you would just go over in your mind, like, why didn't I do this? And then also, I guess, going through that experience, like, do you ever ask yourself, like, maybe you didn't do those things because you needed to have that experience, despite how horrific it probably has been, in order to become the person that you are today? Do you feel like that ever goes in your mind?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I've said it so many times, and I still stand by it today by saying not cutting away that parachute was probably the best decision of my life. I mean, it was so horrendous what happened afterwards and what my family had to go through and what some of my friends went through. But the outcome of it was just amazing. And I mean, a quick example of the same thing, similar, is wearing helmets. You know, a helmet that day saved my life. And then being in Bali for the past almost 2 years, there's been a couple times in the past I slacked on wearing a helmet, so I didn't wear a helmet. And then good examples, I split decision decided to put a helmet on when I was leaving a surf spot in Zimbabwe with a friend of mine. And I mean, a very desolate area, but a dog ran right out in front of me and I hit this dog and I flew off my motorbike and my head was the first thing to strike the ground. And it just made me think, okay, well, there's a reason I put that helmet on that day. And ever since that happened, I always have a helmet no matter what I do when I get on a bike. And that's just another reason that I believe in fate, and that we all have some sort of a reason to be on this planet, you know, and I mean, for that to happen that day, that Scott having accident, for everything to work out the way it did, whether it be me wearing the helmet or landing in the grass field and not on a cement runway, landing in the position that I did, not having any brain damage or any spinal damage, I'm going, there's got to be some sort of a reason that I made the decisions I made that day. And it did make me feel like I have some sort of a purpose. And that's kind of what I've been searching for since I left the U.S. almost 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So can I ask you, would you jump without a helmet at all? Do you have to have one when you're jumping?
You know, I have in the past, and a lot of people will say, oh, you know, why would you wear a helmet? Like when you're jumping out of an airplane. And the biggest thing is, if you're jumping with other people, you know, if somebody does something and, for instance, a foot comes up and makes contact with your head.
Yeah.
At the speeds that you're falling, easy. The helmet could save your life, you know, or for instance, if you were to fly into a field of trees, that helmet's going to save your life. And I had jumped a few times in the past without a helmet, but I mean, I think that was in the first couple of years. Maybe I did one or two. And then once I actually purchased a full face helmet, it just made the jump more satisfying. It was, I don't know if you're familiar with the sport. I think it's luge in the Olympics, and they wear they go down those little like ice paths and like little cart. Well, they wear these real aerodynamic looking helmets. And that was the kind of helmet I was using. Mm-hmm. And it just blocks out all the wind, and it makes for more of a comfortable jump. But I'll be honest, I never really thought about the helmet, really saving my life, mm-hmm. even though I knew there were the possibilities. But for me, it was more of just having a comfortable skydive, you know, versus like a open face helmet. Mm-hmm. But I can definitely say it contributed to saving my life, even though I had some serious damage to my jaw and my face.
Okay, you've blacked out and you've hit the ground, obviously. What do you remember? Do you remember waking up and knowing that you were injured? Because from what I've read in your book, like, you know, that you were somewhat conscious and you could tell that there was something seriously wrong. You had blood coming out from various parts of your face and things like that. Were you conscious of that, or is that information that kind of has been relayed back to you?
It was everything that was relayed back to me, because before the book, I would actually interview everybody that was involved that day to get mm-hmm. everybody's take. And of course, the most emotional one, the hardest one, was interviewing my mom to hear what she had to say.
Yeah,
but I think she gave me some of the best information, along with Rob Stevenson, who's one of the master skydivers at Skydive Sebastian, who I still credit for saving my life, because he was the first one on scene. But from what they saw and what they said, you know, I was semi-conscious when I hit the ground. I was agonal breathing, so I was breathing, but just gasping almost, you know. But when they tried to wake me up or try to gain my attention or whatnot, I was just in and out of consciousness. I think I swallowed some teeth or something. I mean, it was pretty graphic when they got to me and they took the helmet off, and I had all the teeth on my right side were shattered. So I had a lot of stuff in my throat. So my airway had to be cleared. Mm. And once they cleared my airway, I started breathing. And apparently once they got me into the helicopter, I raised up my arm. And I think subconsciously I was raising up my arm just to let my mom know that I'm alive and I'm okay. Mm. And then once in the hospital, I'm not sure I wrote this, but even in the hospital, I was telling the nurse where my pain was. I told her I had pain, or I motioned where I had pain, maybe my leg and my arm and my jaw. Mm-hmm. And then I even relayed my father's cell phone number. I don't remember any of that. You know, the first thing I remember was waking up. It was 5 days later. They put me in the medical induced coma while they inserted the rods in my legs and did all the surgeries and extracted the shattered teeth. And I woke up on my birthday, April 16th. And then the first thing I actually remember was removing the hose that they had in my nose, because they had to nasally intubate me while they did all the surgery on my teeth. Mm-hmm. And I vaguely remember reaching up and just grabbing this hose and pulling it out. And it was the most excruciating pain. But that's when the meds started to slowly wear off. And I think that was the day before my birthday. Mm-hmm. And I remember that. But then the next thing I remember was actually waking up on my birthday and see my family there.
Wow. And what surgeries have you actually had in this process? Because you broke a lot of things and you had your leg was shattered.
Yeah. So both of my femurs were broken. My left femur was broken right in half, right down the center. And then my right femur, because I landed on my right side, was actually it blew out of my leg. It was a compound fracture. So the x-ray is unbelievable when you look at it. It's just bits of bone throughout my femur. And
gosh,
one of the first things I heard from my doctor when I woke up, my surgeon, was that they almost had to amputate my right leg because the fracture was so bad. Because I lost, I think it was three or 4 inches of bone. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty crucial, you know, to do those surgeries on my legs, you know, because I was losing a lot of blood. So those surgeries, they ended up putting two permanent metal rods, one in each leg, from my knee to my hip. Mm-hmm. And then my arm, I fractured. Again, it was just a fracture of the ulna. So the ulna broke right in half. The humerus broke right in half. So the lower and upper arm. Again, those fractures were centered as well. And then I shattered my right condyle. So it's the hinge of your jaw. So mm-hmm. kind of close to your ear.
Yeah,
I fractured and dislocated my left condyle. I shattered the 9 teeth on my right side that had to be extracted. I fractured my skull and I suffered a concussion. And so the procedure was pretty, I mean, it was amazing what they did. You know, my surgeons were just, I can't believe what they did to get me back to how I am today. But yeah, so now the final result is having the two permanent metal rods in my legs, and then a permanent rod in my upper arm. And then I have what looks to be like a bike chain and pins and screws all along my jaw, and still missing the 9 teeth, but you can't really tell. And then after that surgeries, I did have to go through another surgery with my jaw later on because I was put on a rehabilitation for my jaw, which wasn't necessarily ordered by my surgeon. So when I went back to see him, turned out that what I had been doing was actually more harm than good. So then I had to go through a process of getting my whole jaw redone, kind of realigned. And then they had to wire my mouth shut for 2 months. So that was one of the hardest parts about the rehab process, was that surgery, because all of a sudden I was in a wheelchair, and now all of a sudden I was like, okay, my mouth is going to be wired shut for 2 months. I'm not going to be able to eat anything, just like a liquid diet. And I think everybody that knows me knows that I love to eat. And then, so I'm sitting there in the U.S. seeing all these commercials for McDonald's, all this food. I'm like, oh my gosh, I just want to eat something so bad. But that was probably the hardest surgery, was that one, waking up with a mouth that was now wired shut.
So by that, do you mean like, did you have any ability to have your, how did you consume like your liquid diets? Or was it completely like your mouth was completely shut and you just weren't going to open it for 2 months?
Well, I could still, like, I could still talk. Again, all the teeth on my right side were gone. So even though my mouth was wired shut, they could only wire the left side and the front. So mm-hmm. I had wires from all my front teeth to my back, all my teeth on my left side. But then again, I had that gap, so I could still get a straw in there. Mm-hmm. But then towards the end, like, my uncle got me this really amazing blender, and I started just blending everything. I blended cereal with milk. I think I blended like chili with like, I blended some really strange things because mm-hmm. I got so tired of the same like smoothies and everything. And I was trying to put weight on.
Yeah.
I think at one point I even chopped up solid foods.
Yeah.
And I shoveled it in my mouth with chopsticks, and I'd use my tongue to kind of like break it down. And I mean, I just did some kind of odd things because 2 months was such a long time. And then, yeah, to just have to go the same diet over and over again for that long and dropping weight, it was interesting. And then I always remember if I had to yawn, it was really painful because I'd go to yawn. It's like that natural thing that you want to do. And then I just couldn't. So that was always kind of an odd thing. And I had a friend that would come see me in the hospital, my friend Dusty, and we just, he'd get me laughing so hard. And when I'd be laughing uncontrollably with a wired, with my mouth wide shut, that was also kind of, I think, painful at times. And then, yeah, it was a really, really odd experience having my mouth wired shut. But I was never like miserable about it. I just kind of went with it, you know, but it was the food, not having, you know, the solid food was what made it kind of, more of a pain than anything, obviously, you know?
Yeah. Okay. So you say you were miserable, which is kind of what I wanted to ask you about as well. What was your outlook on life like while you were in a wheelchair and you're, you know, recovering from these surgeries? How were you viewing life at that time?
While I was in the wheelchair, and it, you know, it was really tough because I had no idea what my future was going to be like. I mean, I think until you experience something where break your legs and your body's just completely shattered. Most of the time you hear of this, like a car accident or a motorcycle accident. And I think once you're in that position, you really can't, the best way to say it is you can't see any sort of a light at the end of the tunnel. You know, you just feel like you don't know what to expect. Mm. And I didn't know if I was going to walk. I didn't, I mean, again, I've expressed it so many times, how much I love surfing. It's like, when am I ever going to be able to surf again? You know, am I going to walk? And like, just not knowing that outcome of what your future is going to be like, it's tough. It's tough to stay positive. Mm. And, you know, music for me was a big a motivator, you know, just to listen to music that would keep my spirits up. But yeah, I can't say I was miserable, but I was really confused on it. I was confused and I was definitely sad at times, but just not knowing what was going to be, you know. And I really had to live out that 11 months of rehabilitation before I started really having my life fall back into place. But the 11 months was interesting. And even though it's a quick recovery time for what had happened to me, it was definitely, it was a lot of drama at times and just confusion, you know?
Yeah. Were you fearful as well during that time?
I guess I was fearful. The fact that thinking to myself that maybe I will never walk again, maybe I will never do what I love again.
Yeah.
There had to have been some fear in what I was thinking, but a lot of it was confusion, you know, but always really trying to stay focused and stay positive. And that's why I began writing, because that I felt like that actually like brightened my spirits. And, oh, and also I have to mention Karina Holicum.
Yeah.
Who suffered a very similar accident that I experienced, and I got a hold of her, and she actually contacted me back with the best advice, because she went through basically the same thing I did. And she told me, she's like, don't focus on the big things that are going to make you upset. You have to focus on the little things that you do every day that are helping you improve, whether it's like tying your shoes or getting out of bed that much easier than the day before. And I really started focusing on all of that. And just that one bit of advice really got me to think, okay, I'm getting better, you know, and I started really documenting how I was feeling and my progress. And I think that really was the turning point for me and overcoming that fear and overcoming that confusion, you know, and just going, okay, it is going to get better. It's getting better. I'm already doing this. And last week I couldn't move. And today I got out of bed for the first time with only the help of one physical therapist. I just focus on the little things, and it's really seemed to help me out.
Wow. That's such wonderful advice. I guess it really enabled you to come back to the moment and not focus so much on the future and just really go moment by moment.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do you feel that this experience has made you appreciate life more, and are you living your life differently to how you were before?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, it's after it happened, and then once I got my life back, and I really did, I lost some things that I'll always love, like skateboarding, and I always wanted to go back to playing soccer. And there's some things that physically now I could do, but I'd only do that for about 5 minutes before I'd injure myself. But surfing is still my life.
Yeah.
And when I got back to my life, I had surfing back. I started skydiving again. I was lifeguarding again, and I was doing all these things, and I had limited issues really. And I still have issues with my knees, but So then after a couple years of having my life back, I just thought to myself, and it was during while I was writing this book as well, going, okay, well, I now feel like I have this like bonus life where I should have lost mine that day. And the fact that I didn't, I had the second chance. Mm. So I said, I really can't do any wrong now. Why not just go and do the most, not crazy thing I can think of, but really step outside of my comfort zone and do something that I feel could really make me happy and make me live my life to the fullest. And then by leaving to go in lifeguard in Australia was something I never would have thought of when I even started lifeguarding in Florida, because I had this whole idea of, oh, I'm going to become a firefighter and, you know, probably live in Cocoa Beach or Brevard County, the area where I grew up in. And I don't know if I ever really thought about starting a family, but I had all these thoughts that before, all of a sudden after this accident, it was like, I don't think I want any of that stuff now. I think I want to go and see what else is out there and just experience my life as much as I can. And I think in the nearly 4 years I've been gone, I've done a pretty good job of it. And I still have to remind myself though, almost every day, you know, it's like, I have to remind myself what happened to me and what I'm actually doing and that I do feel there's purpose and I'm still searching for it. But I know that I'm definitely utilizing my new bonus life as much as I can, you know, and just trying to be happy every day and just try new things, new adventures and meet new people.
Gosh, what an incredible experience. I mean, I have so many questions. I could talk to you for ages, but obviously like we have limited time. Tell me what moves you.
I think this is the first time anyone's ever even asked me this, but it probably would have to be the people that I meet that really inspire me and keep me going, you know?
Yeah, that's beautiful. It's so much about the connection that we have with other people. I mean, I agree with you because I feel very much the same with all the people I get to chat to and talk to about their stories. You know, I find that connection with someone and just hearing so much about them, such a enriching and really special thing.
Yeah.
Mm. Tell me what scares you.
A normal life scares me. That's what scares me. I mean, for so long now, I feel like I've been living like this fantasy life. You know, I've got so many people at home, people I don't even know or people I went to school with that I've only maybe met once or twice. Hey, I always hear you're living the dream, bro. And I wake up in the morning and I'm like, well, maybe I kind of am. But the normal life scares me. I don't want to have to work a job I don't like, follow the normal rules of society and do all. It's like, no, I'd rather just do my own thing and just surf and enjoy this life and the time that I have here on earth, you know? So yeah, to sum it up, a normal life definitely scares me.
Perfect. If you weren't in your career path, what would you like to attempt?
You know, I've always wanted to be a singer. I've always wanted to be on stage singing because I listen to music. Yeah. I think I even have a little bit of background music playing from my phone right now.
Right.
I always have music on. I love music. It's up there with surfing, maybe even more than surfing. So I would love to maybe follow the path of being a professional singer. I don't know if I have that skill, but then I also recently told one of my friends after a couple of drinks, I wouldn't mind acting as well. I was like, because I love public speaking. I love getting on stage and delivering a speech. Obviously, I need the practice to really make it a good one. But yeah, I was like, oh, maybe acting would be kind of fun. So I'm only 33, so I think there's time to maybe make some of those things a reality if I really want them and strive for them, you know?
Totally, absolutely. And tell me, what's the greatest piece of advice that you've been given?
I'll have to go back to what Karina Holcomb told me from being in the hospital and telling me not to focus, because I can use that, not to focus on the big things that I can't do now, but focus on the little things that are going to get me to where I need to be. Because I think about that even now, and I love making lists. You know, that's one of my favorite things to do is make a list. And I think that's why I really enjoyed writing. You know, I go off on these weird lists of things to do, but you can do that with goals that you have. You know, you can think of the most outrageous thing ever and go, this is what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's that saying, you can, you know, you dream big, but you got to start kind of small. You take those baby steps and focus on those little things that are going to get you to that big goal, because every little piece is going to help. Yeah. And so I take what Karina Holcomb told me when I was injured, and I still use that in my everyday now. I'm going, okay, well, for instance, I want to maybe own my own surf camp in the future. Mm. Okay, well, I've spent quite a long time lifeguarding, you know, and that helps a bit as far as being ocean aware, everything like that. And then surf coach, I've done that. Well, now I'm in management, and I'll be honest, I don't necessarily like it that much.
Yeah.
But I'm going, okay, well, this is a step that could ultimately get me to where I want to go.
Yeah.
So that's definitely the best advice I've been given, because I used it then to recover, and I still use it to today to get to the goals I want to achieve.
Yeah, perfect. It is such awesome advice, because we really can only go moment by moment, and it's
exactly.
And not missing all the little steps that we get to the bigger ones, because we're, you know, taking everything in and appreciating what we have at the time that we have it.
Exactly.
Mm. Well, that wraps up our interview for today. So thanks so much for talking to me. It's been such a pleasure to get to know you.
Yeah, thanks for everything, Micah.